This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, hello, everyone. I'm glad to be back. My new abode, feeling very comfortable indeed in here. There was some feng shui involved in the creation of this this office, and I love working in it. I hardly ever leave it now. Thanks to Crystal Kelly and her team. She's really quite a social media person and a doer, boy. I mean, she came in here with a massive crew, and they did this. Okay, we've got a fascinating show today. After the flying saucers came, what happened? Well, we have a guest here who is a extraordinary expert who can tell us a few things about what happened in the recent years, and also what happened in the deep past. We tend to kind of ignore that. I'd like to introduce Greg Akagian. I hope I've got your pronunciation of your name correct.
Yeah, spot on.
Greg is a professor of history and bioethics at Pennsylvania State University. He describes himself as an expert on the abnormal and the paranormal in the modern world. And so we're going to be concentrating on the abnormal today. The paranormal is nothing to us. we're going to be flying over both countries today. His work has been supported by NASA and the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. He's the author of The Corrigible and the Incorrigible, Science, Medicine, and the Convict in the 20th Century, and the editor in 20th Century Germany, excuse me, and The Rutledge History of Madness and Mental Health, and After the Flying Saucers Came. So, Greg, I think the first question we need to ask is, are we all mad or not? You might actually know the answer.
Are we all mad or not? I suppose if we are all mad, that kind of means that we're not mad, because then we're all in the same boat. Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of an interesting question. I must admit that when I embarked on this project, I as you point out, I've worn a lot of different hats as a historian, and I've had a lot of different interests, but I have written fairly extensively about the history of madness, and how madness has been understood and dealt with, and how people who have been supposedly considered to be mad have been treated. I must admit, when I began this project about UFOs, I did not think that that world would in any way sort of play a role in this world. And then it did in surprising ways, not in the ways in which I think some people think I might think, but rather in the ways in which a lot of ideas and a lot of people who I had known about through these other sort of avenues of knowledge came to enter onto the stage in ways that utterly surprised me. And I will tell you, that's the stuff I like to do. That's part of the reason I took up this project, is I like to be surprised.
I'm curious about your taking up of the project, because it's a departure. I mean, you're a very well-respected and established academic, and all of a sudden you have strayed into some dangerous territory. It wasn't dangerous anymore. What inspired you to do this?
Well, the most direct thing was that I had been talking with a colleague of mine, a historian actually, who was working on a project that involved looking at the kind of revival of the occult that took place after World War II in Europe. And I was not familiar with that. I knew there was a kind of a flourishing of the occult around World War One and afterwards, but I didn't know that. And I had asked her, I said, you know, I wonder, do you know if this whole flying saucer thing took off in Europe at the time? And she said, I have no idea. Why don't you write about that? I'm like, no, I don't have time. I've got other things to do. And yes, we, you know, I am nothing if not a nerdy historian. So the curiosity got the better of me. And there I found myself digging through old newspapers, German newspapers to start with, to see if there were things in the 40s and 50s. And sure enough, there it was. But that really was really motivated by a deep interest I've always had in it. I was like so many people, certainly my age and almost everybody I ever talked to, whoever was interested in this, I was fascinated with this as growing up. And so it was a return. It was a homecoming, if you will, for me. And that's how I got there.
Well, in my opinion, all I can say is welcome to nerd heaven.
That's it is, isn't it?
Listen, free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a brief break. Enjoy these commercials. And above all, subscribe to unknowncountry.com. And subscribers, tell your friends. We need you. We'll be right back. We're talking to Greg Akigian. His new book is After the Flying Saucers Came, a really fascinating deep dive into just what is going on. And you know what I'd like to do? One of the things about the book that I really liked is the exploration of the far past. It's definitely in there. And you know, back years ago when we were just starting out in this, Ann and I, we were going over to Bud Hopkins's house and we saw a book called Passport to Magonia by Jeff Kripal in his bookshelf. And he poo-pooed it. He said, oh, that's not worth reading. And it doesn't have anything to do with what we're up against, which was flying saucers with very bad little men in them. And after we left, Ann said, we're going to go down to the Strand bookstore, a used bookstore in Manhattan right now, and get that book. And we might get two copies if they have them, because we're both reading it right now. And she thought it was the most important book ever written on UFOs up to that time. This was probably back in 1986. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about the deep past and how it intersects with the modern UFO phenomenon.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing about the past is we like to think it's all gone away. And in many ways, I think maybe it's a curious feature of Americans in particular, where we are always seem to be rushing headlong into the future and leaving, thinking that we're leaving the past behind. But the thing about the past is that it has a way of having created all sorts of pathways of thinking and behaving and feeling that we're completely unaware of. And we can think of that in our own personal lives, but it happens as a society. It happens as a culture as well. And so for me, one of the things that motivated this book was that, and there were many things that did, but one of them was to sit there and ask the question, how did we get to where we are now in conversation about UFOs and aliens? We're at a certain point. There's certain kinds of types of ways of discussing, debating, thinking about it, right? And mulling it over and speculating. Well, how did we get there? And when you start to unpack that, it necessarily then leads one to go back to, well, some beginning. And the question then you have is, any historian always asks themselves, where do I start this story? And I started with flying saucers. I started with Kenneth Arnold's sighting in 1947 as at least a place to somewhat begin this. I do go back further, as you note. But I start there because that's when a certain kind of way of talking and thinking about this emerged. and sort of got bundled or packaged in a certain way. And that is namely this idea that there are these objects, that they are mysterious, that they appear to have a certain sort of form, and that we suspect they have to be something not of this earth. And namely, of course, as we know, likely to be extraterrestrial. That whole kind of repertoire, ensemble, right, of ideas and visions and all struck me as the really good beginning point to then see how all of this then plays out over time and over the decades. As you said, I go back further than that to talk about some other histories that I think help to shape that moment in turn. But that's where I feel like, in many ways, the modern, this modern story begins.
Yeah, and you talk also about the ghost rockets in Sweden. And it seems to me that after World War II, something was broken in reality. Perhaps it started really with the Foo Fighters in World War II. And it goes back, it kind of dribbles back into the past. In other words, if you go back to 1850, you could find in Northern Europe a lot of people who were seeing the fairy folk, who weren't so different from the gray aliens. I mean, if you look carefully into the descriptions of the fairy folk, it's not Tinkerbell, not at all. Mm-hmm. It's someone with... a perfect example is a lullaby that says, "Go away, peery fairies, come down, bonny angels." And that peery fairies, of course, it referred to those big eyes. So that form was there, but it was kind of in the woods somewhere, and not in our faces. Now, right. Because of me, it's in our faces.
It's in our faces. It is all because of you. That's true.
You know, I'm a bad boy. I always think to myself after I pass on, if I'm going to start to try to ascend off of this realm, and I'm going to be pulled down, and someone's going to say, "Wait a minute, you got a little karma to work out." I hope not. I hope I did the right thing. But you know, increasingly, the older you get, the more you look at your life and you wonder. But in any case, yeah. That aside, tell us a little bit about the ghost rockets, because something kind of fractured in the psyche. I think we begin to see something more clearly after facing death as a species in World War II, and then with the advent of the atomic bomb.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And the thing about it is, you know, my whole approach to this is to say, what I'm interested in is, and this is where I feel like my voice as a historian is slightly different than some of the other voices that maybe people are most familiar with who talk about this. And that is namely, I don't actually attempt to ask, nor do I try to answer the question about the ontological reality of UFOs per se. I'm interested in letting the historical actors do that, right? Let them speak for themselves. Let them tell us what they think or what they thought, and to sort of re-excavate that and represent that, because we tend to forget that. And so one of the fascinating things is just what you describe, is that at the time, in 1946, in 1947, well into the early 50s, as this idea and these speculations emerge and these sightings start popping up, there is, in fact, a lot of conversation on the part of people from all walks of life across the world of a deep, profound sense of not just anxiety, but dread, and of course, a deep awareness of mortality. The scale of carnage, the scale of cruelty and atrocity of World War II, coupled with then this new device, this atomic bomb that had been a secret by one of the major powers, then sets the world on a whole new pathway that seems to indicate to a lot of people back then seems less so now for too many people, I think. But back then seemed to be a continuation of that carnage, leading to something that seemed like utter extinction of humanity. We forget that. We forget that kind of sense of deep fear and sense of one's own mortality, not only as individuals, but as a species, that is that, I think, is the key to that fracture that you talk about. Yeah.
Oh, I remember it very well. In the 50s, I was a little boy, and we had bomb drills at our school. I remember how terrifying it was to when they would organize these convoys where the parents would take us out to a safe area outside of the city, and I had to ride in the car of another family. It wasn't my mother's car, because it was just you just stood in line and a car would come up and you got in, because the idea was to do it quickly. It was frightening beyond belief. But what's not frightening, folks, is you're going to listen to some really cool ads right now if you're on the free side. We'll be right back. We're talking to Greg Akigian. After the flying saucers came, a historian, a really accomplished historian, I might add. He probably was embarrassed to hear that, but takes a look at the flying saucer phenomenon. You are very careful in the book about the relationship between skepticism, doubt, and witness testimony. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to the phenomenon and to a skeptical but not denying view of it?
Yeah, so you know, there were two things about skepticism. One was, of course, how I myself was to come to this. What framework, what attitude should I adopt to come to this subject? I knew when I came to this topic and to engage it as I was going to, I needed to think about just that very issue. And there, the attitude I adopted was one I've always sort of adopted, and I think, frankly, most historians do, about a subject, which is to say that, as I said before, you're interested in as much as possible to let the witnesses, let the historical actors speak for themselves. And then what you do is you attempt to try to situate them in their context. What that means, therefore, is to respect their perspective as being an authentic perspective on things, but to also recognize, and this is where the distance comes in, is that their vision of something is, of course, going to be colored by their particular place in space and time, wherever they're situated, right? So that becomes the key to the historian. So for me, I adopt a distance to the subject. And that is where, again, I say it very clearly in the book. My attitude, my approach to this is really my own attitude, which is I am not seeking to try to prove a certain point about what the phenomenon is about, or neither am I trying to play the debunker here. And that was that's the second part of this, was to do something that I have not seen done a lot of really in the literature. And that is to also say that skepticism and debunking also have a history. They too, as skeptics and debunkers and their projects, they too have come out and evolved over time, right? And unfolded over time. And they have adopted certain roles in conversations about phenomena like the UFO. They've adopted a certain sort of position for themselves that also needs to be, as I said, placed in a very similar kind of context. And when you do that, I think you start to discover some surprising things. I think one of the things that made me very happy was I recently was talking with Michael Shermer, the very famous skeptic, on his podcast. And he said, I learned a lot of things about skepticism I didn't know about, right? I didn't even know where the term debunking came from. That to me was a source of some pleasure to be able to say, you know, these are, maybe you can start to see the very thing you're looking at in a novel way.
I had an interesting experience with Michael Shermer on Bill Maher's show when he was on ABC many, many years ago. I knew I was going to be beaten up, but in those days I was so used to it, it just I had to get out there with the story, and I had to just take it. However, I went into the green room and they were talking together and they didn't see me. And they were plotting, Bill Maher and Michael Shermer, about how to destroy me on the air. And I listened to the whole thing and formed my debate strategy based on theirs, and realizing it. And I have to admit, Michael did not do well in that debate. In fact, afterwards, he went rushing out of the studio in a fury.
There you go.
Yeah, so I
thought, had the advantage on them.
What do you say?
You had the advantage on them because you had been able to.
Yeah, because they didn't. They thought. I mean, they obviously thought I was a complete pushover.
Yeah.
Little did they know that the visitors are real, and they weren't stupid about who they chose. I won debate. I was in debate in high school and college, and I won a lot of debate. I know a good deal about that. So now what happened after the Cold War was this unease occurs, and the UFO kind of comes into it, and we get people like the early contactees, George Adamski and the other people, and they seem like such frauds to me. Like, yeah, just a bunch of people trying to make money. Were they outright frauds, in your opinion, or did they have something happen to them and then they kind of conflated it into something bigger than it was?
Yeah, it's a really difficult thing to say. I think there's no question. In fact, some people have been revealed to have been frauds. And con artists who are trying to maybe make a buck or become famous. It's difficult to say. The thing that you see that is common, Adamski's a good version of it, but there are others, like George Van Tassel and others. Orfeo Angelucci is another who even well before the supposed contact, the experience they had, they had been quite taken up by esoteric philosophies, or I suppose you'd call them today New Age religious ideas and worldviews, and had been exploring them. In the case of Adamski, he'd been already doing this for decades. And then the flying saucer phenomenon comes along, and they see in it something deeply meaningful. They see this as, and of course we have to remember it, the millennium is coming to an end in 50 years. So there's a kind of a millenarianism in it as well that's operating. But they see in that something deeply, deeply meaningful, that this might be a sign of some kind. You might argue, I've seen people make the argument that people like Adamski and Angelucci and others maybe actually had an experience. But what happened is that experience was then quickly folded into that worldview. And then they sort of ran with it. And then it became bigger than that event, right? That kind of thing took place. That's the most, probably one of the more generous viewpoints that people hold about it.
That is generous. Yeah. But you know, I'm in the same boat. Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs would have said that happened to me, that basically I had a horrible experience, which I certainly did. I mean, there's nothing like a rectal probe to make your evening, believe me. And, I was in shock for days and then struggled with PTSD without really knowing I had it for a couple of years afterwards, including during the Communion author tour, which was made it all very, very difficult. But Bud and Dave feel that this is an intrusion into human experience by a physical presence that has some kind of a negative agenda that involves exploiting us. I see this as an initiatory experience, whether that's true or not. Yeah. How do you kind of respond to that combination of sort of disparate but curiously linked attitudes?
Yeah, I mean, that to me has been one of the more fascinating and also head-scratchingly difficult set of speculations and theorizings that I've had to sort of grapple with in this. I mean, the thing that's interesting to me is that even before that point, and you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but when I read Communion, especially that period of time in your writing and your newsletter and things like that from that time, it strikes me that you are not just simply folding this into a ready-made ideology or philosophy. You're searching, and there's a lot of, I see you experimenting in Communion with a lot of different ideas. I love the sections where you go through different variations on the theme and just think about what might be possible. That whole conversation that divide between, yes, Hopkins and Jacobs on one hand with this sort of, yes, physical reality, invaders bent on colonizing us and conquest versus your voice. I think John Mack's voice was similar to yours. I think Leo Sprinkle, as I talk about in the book, was one who was articulating that even earlier than just about anybody, because he was starting to discuss this already back in the I think it's late 60s, early 70s. So it seemed to me that what you had was this sense that everybody agreed something that is deeply, deeply shocking and traumatizing is occurring. But then what you have is this sense of where do we go from there as individuals, but then obviously as a community talking about this. And that struck me as the intriguing thing for me to sort of look at more carefully. The consequences of what happens when you go down one pathway versus another pathway, the pathway that you adopt and John Mack adopted versus the pathway that Dave Jacobs and Bud Hopkins adopted, and the kinds of ways in which people find meaning in those. That strikes me as a deeply human venture, right? As one where you end up having to explore a lot about yourself, right? Not just about the experiences, but yourself as well.
Yeah, you sure do, because you get, you know, in my case, in the early contactee stories, there is, I don't recall exactly which ones, maybe yours, but they have stories of sex with beautiful blonde bombshells from Venus and whatnot. And I had that experience too, but it was no blonde bombshell. It was a very, very difficult experience. And yet it seems to me to have been real in some way. Jeff Kripal, in the book we wrote together, Supernatural, has a very interesting take on it. He says that he thinks that it was Anne in kind of another sort of supernatural form. Because, and he draws that conclusion. It's not really a conclusion. It's sort of an exploration of a possibility from the fact that Anne was so completely indifferent to it. I was so ashamed when I told her about it. I thought, and I'm such a stick in the mud when it comes to oaths and things and lies. I can't do that. And I can't break a vow. It's inconceivable. And yet I did. And she said, well, it wasn't your fault. I said, well, there was nothing I could do about it, but I'm so ashamed, honey, and I apologize. She said something along the lines of, well, let her come in and apologize. And she was just blew it off.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, you know, what is going on here? Because where I'm going here with this is, and I'm not sure it's I'm fairly sure it's a path you want to go down at least a little ways. What is the relationship, the real relationship between us and them? Because it's so intimate. It seems so dangerous, so beautiful, wrapped up into one. John Mack and I are on one side of the fence. Yeah. Bud and Dave are on another. But shouldn't we all be in the same house?
Yeah.
In different rooms?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, in some sense, yeah, you could say that. But it, once again, this is who we are, human beings. This is what one of the things history shows us. We can all have, or at least some share of the human race can have similar kinds of experiences, and yet come away from them with very different perspectives on them. And to me, when we use that as an opportunity to share and to converse and to exchange ideas in a civil manner, then it's actually, to me, one of the wonderful things about a human being and humanity. It's one of the things that I've mentioned this to Jeff Kripal before, that to me is one of the things that makes the human story, the human history of these kinds of encounters, to me, really, really fascinating, but also instructive for us. Now, of course, not everybody does that, right? Not everybody comes away feeling that the differences make us better, maybe give us a bigger picture than we'd otherwise have, right? Some people see it as, well, no, it's time to set up turf. It's time to set up boundaries, and there's you, and there's us, and it's them. That's when I think things get unfortunate. And so I agree with you, yeah.
Well, in that case, politics is sort of basically unfortunate. you know what we're going to do, folks? We're going to take a final break for our free side. We'll be right back. We're talking to Greg Aghighian. His new deep dive into the UFO phenomenon, very nuanced and very different from the books you might be seeing out there, which are coming in increasing numbers, all too many of which have the flavor of AI in the writing. And they're being written very quickly. And this is not the case with After the Flying Saucers Came. This is something you can really learn from. And it's also fascinating because, Greg, you tell a good story.
Oh, good. That's a compliment coming from a great story writer. So thank you.
Well, yeah, a great story. Yeah, that's another reason they pick me, I think, is because I'm a good storyteller. You know, when I was a boy in Texas, we had a tradition. It's sort of like everything. The old Texas has kind of been swept away. But in the Texas I grew up, there were tall tales. And Texans prided themselves on their ability to tell tall tales. My dad was a master of the tall tale. And when I was a young man, I used to tell tall tales too. And then a tall tale actually happened to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I couldn't tell any fake tall tales anymore. But then again, I didn't need to either, did I? Because I had my own real tall tale. Now, I want to get on to the difference, and you discuss this, and it's quite fascinating. I don't know of any book that's ever discussed this before, the difference between the approaches of European UFO researchers and American UFO researchers, which were quite striking to me. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, One of the things that was, I knew I was going to have to do with this book was to talk about something that rarely gets talked about. And that's to look at the international, the global scale, not just of sightings, but of the way in which people have built up groups and organizations and written about this and organized conferences and meetings to discuss and analyze cases. I was going to need to do that. And so one of the things that you see, as you point out, is that there are different parts of the world outside of the United States that are deeply invested in this question. One area was South America, but the other was Europe. And the Europeans, you know, one of the things you got to keep in mind is when the flying saucer sightings start happening, and that includes the ghost rockets in 1946, for a lot of Europeans, this is very, very scary stuff, because, you know, aerial bombing and destruction of cities from the skies was not just some sort of thing that they had to conjure up in their imagination. It was in their memories, very recent history in the late 40s and early 50s. And so there's a lot of interest in this subject, and they too start creating groups and organizations, and you start having ufology researchers emerging already in the mid-1950s. Some of them going to go on to become quite famous, right? Aimé Michel probably being one of the early ones, and Jacques Vallée was certainly influenced by a lot of those folks. But the Europeans by the 60s, 70s, and 80s start to really develop this idea that maybe the way to start understanding the phenomenon is to see it in relationship to psychology, human psychology, and human culture and history. And so they start doing deep dives into history, into psychological research. And for some of them, it's going to lead them more into the direction of a kind of a skepticism. For others, it's not going to lead them into skepticism so much as it's going to lead them into say that maybe the key to understanding all this doesn't lie in, you know, better instruments and in government investigations, but it lies really in exploring our human subjectivity, how we think, our consciousness. And so in a sense, it leads them to look more inward. And I think that's a key moment that has an impact back then in the United States, and other people then in the US start to take that up. So that by the 70s and 80s, really, the Europeans start to have a very different take on things, and there's some really interesting moments when you look at some of their meetings in the 80s, and they're like, you know, we don't understand the Americans anymore and what they're up to, because this doesn't map onto the way that we have started to think about how to approach the subject.
The abduction phenomenon isn't. Or the, and I should say, let me speak more broadly. The close encounter phenomenon isn't very present in Europe, right, but it is in North and South America, and very different in the two areas. In North America, you find abduction stories. People are taken, things are done to them, they're brought back. In South America, it's a much more violent situation where people will be walking down a path and they suddenly be followed by something that starts to shoot beams of light at them. People are injured. People are terrified. They're made sick. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different ball of wax. It's like in North America, one group of, if you will, aliens is abducting people in a very organized way. And in South America, they're like hunting them and terrorizing them. Yeah. Why is it like that? And then in Europe, it's hardly happening at all.
Yeah, or when it does happen, it plays out in unusual ways. I mean, the thing that you get with a lot of the Europeans was you do get a lot of stories about, you know, as I talk about in the book, little men encounters. And then, you know, you even get some of these encounters in, when I looked at other parts of the world, like Malaysia, there's discussion that in fact most of the encounters are with beings who are less than a foot tall. They're many of them are just 6 inches high, right? So that you do seem to see this. My own take on this is that, and this is where I think more research needs to be done by people who understand these cultural dimensions of things. But this seems to me, again, to be the nature of how we humans deal with any kind of anomalous phenomenon, or even things that are not anomalous, but just simply mundane. And that is, we can only sort of understand and perceive the world through that cultural and social lens that exists for us. So I tend to see these things as not undermining people's experiences, but what they do is they're cast in a certain light and can be sort of remembered and then recounted in ways that fit into existing sort of, as I like to often call it, an existing repertoire of ideas and feelings and narratives. Because I think the thing that one does see consistently among people in history who've talked about encounters in certain ways is you tend to see this sense that I can't quite get my words together to describe this. I can't quite remember everything that happened, right? I'm fumbling for the ideas and the concepts to make sense of this. That's where I think you start to see human beings having to rely on those resources that you have readily available to you, whether that's your personality, whether that's your family upbringing, whether that's your culture. That to me seems to me that human dimension that always has to play a role. Why would it not play a role? You know, that's the way I kind of see it.
Interestingly enough, in Indonesia, the culture has, there are quite a few different, very, very small beings that are in the mystical, in the supernatural tradition in that country, including one group that is now being thought to actually be real, which were known as the Orang Tanda. I wrote a novel some years ago about them. This happens to so too many of my books. Now there are scientists who think they might actually be a subspecies, a very small human subspecies. Huh. Now, what's fascinating about this is in the West, in the United States, we're very tall by comparison, say, to Indonesians. Their aliens are very small.
Mm-hmm.
Our aliens tend to be very tall. We have the Nordics. We have the tall whites. Actually, one of the smaller species is the grays, who are 5 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And then the little dwarfs that are near them are separate. But there's some kind of strange reflectivity here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm because I think it has something to do not with necessarily what's actually there in mm-hmm. some objective way, but the way we see through the lens of our culture and our expectations. How do you, I know you address this sort of indirectly in the book. We're going to get on to abductions in just a minute, but maybe this is too vague a question. If it is, we'll go on. But do you have a response to that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, there's a very famous adage in the world of clinical psychology that used to be about the nature of dream interpretation in psychoanalysis, and made the point. Somebody once coined the term or the adage: Freudians have Freudian dreams. Jungians have Jungian dreams, right? That one's dreams tend to sort of replicate that kind of understanding you have of your own dreams. And so Freudian patients have Freudian dreams and Jungian patients have Jungian dreams. I think there's something absolutely to this idea that this reflexivity, that there's a give and take going on here between the experience and then the way in which people come to the experience, but also then, if in a sense, inhabit that experience, right? And it inhabits you. It's going to reside inside all of that world, that ecosystem that is your own sort of consciousness. It seems to me almost inevitable that we are going to play a role in all of that as well.
I can certainly see that, and we do. I mean, we do play a role in structuring what we see. And I wouldn't be surprised if nobody's ever actually seen in an objective way what's there.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody in the history of the planet, quite possibly. And of course, unfortunately, we can't know that. It's just a kind of theory, because we never see anything really, as so many idealists, I believe they're called, point mm-hmm. out. We can only react to what our senses deliver to us. And there's a whole very complex set of studies about how the brain organizes experience. And for example, when you're looking at something, your brain, you'd think, well, your brain was primarily occupied with the optics, the optic nerve, but it's not. It's really looking mostly into its own memory for comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make sense of something that you can't make comparisons. Okay, we have come to the end of our time with our free side. We're going to go into some fascinating subjects. We're going to go into the abductions. We're going to go into the government and the military and their struggles and technological changes that may have come out of this, and also the technologies that we are trying to use to study it. So we've got a lot to go yet. Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland. We're talking to Greg Akigian. His new book, After the Flying Saucers Came, a serious deep dive into this phenomenon of a kind that there are too little of, and yet our academic community is beginning to respond to this. And this is an example of what can be done when a professional, highly trained researcher begins to address this situation. Now, let me ask you this. When did you first become aware of the alien abduction phenomenon?
I first became aware of it, I think, in my childhood, reading John Fuller's book, The Interrupted Journey, about Betty and Barney Hill. I think that's the first time I became aware of it. I can't tell you when. So I grew up I was a young child in the 60s. So I probably started reading it around, I'd say sometime around 1970, probably was when I started to read about it. And that was my introduction to alien abduction and reading John Fuller's account, which included obviously a lot of transcripts from the hypnotic session.
Yeah, I didn't read that until after my experience. I did read the Look magazine article that came out, I believe, in 1964, was it? Somewhere, yeah, 1964. And I was fascinated by it, but I didn't, by the time 20 years had passed and my own abduction came, didn't come to mind. I have to admit, I had forgotten about it. Friends tell me that when the subject of UFOs came up before my abduction experience, I tended to just poo-poo it or say I didn't want to talk about it. And one friend said an interesting thing. He said, you became very hostile. You really did not want to talk about it. And yet, under the surface, there was an awful lot going on. And let me ask you this. What do you think the abduction narrative means?
Boy, that is a big question.
You can answer it in little slices.
Or you can.
I'm kind of inviting you.
Yes.
To really speculate here.
The abduction experience. This is the way I would approach it. Is for me, the abduction experience is not completely, but in large measure, inaccessible. It's clearly inaccessible or difficult to access for many people who have the experience, right? But what I mean by inaccessible is that, as I had said before, you see this with a lot of encounters, but particularly with the abduction phenomenon and the abduction experience, is the difficulty most people describe having piecing it all together. People eventually do piece it together, as you did, but also as people who I know wrote you all those letters over the years. But that to me is then another aspect or another layer of the experience. That is the need and the value that people place upon constructing a cohesive and coherent story or set of stories about the experience. So for me, as a historian, the experience itself is at a remove from the stories, and in large measure for most any of us, and particularly for those of us outside of an individual's experience, our only avenue of making any sense of it is through the stories that people tell. So to me, I see the importance of story making, story relating, storytelling as a critical dimension in how we understand the experience. And that story making and storytelling and story hearing, to me, in essence, is the way that we come to understand the experience. The experience itself seems to me so deeply difficult to get to for certainly those of us on the outside. And as I say, when I read about the way people describe it, and when I talk to people who've had the experience, that is one of the things I keep hearing, is that difficulty in trying to get to it and to sort of understand what are the boundaries of the experience, where am I maybe adding something on, or is this related or is this not related? That to me is the element that makes it just so much more opaque in so many ways.
The phenomenon, or I should say the way we think about it, in the 40s, at late 40s, and then especially during the 50s, there was an enormous amount of interest. And then it kind of faded. The phenomenon itself faded. In other words, UFO sightings dropped off in the 60s. And we began to see all sorts of things, but that was not because of things in the sky. They were in the head.
Right.
Others, I never did, but others did. And then in the 70s, they came back with a vengeance. And I'm so fascinated by the connection between this pulse of sightings and encounters and the culture, because why did the culture turn away from it in the 60s? Did it really stop, or did we become preoccupied with other things? Because I remember the 60s very well as being a time of intense cultural conflict in the United States. So can you speak to what might have happened? And then we're going to get into the way research changed in the 70s and the way the experience changed and the coming of the abduction phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, the 60s are, as you rightly say, 60s, particularly the second half of the 60s, you start to see this kind of, as you say, a kind of dormant period that lasts into the early 70s. Some of it is maybe the cold water that was thrown on the phenomenon by the famous, some would say infamous, Condon Committee, the scientific committee that was formed and funded by the Air Force to study UFOs and declared really there's nothing worthy of research in the phenomenon. But I think part of it was also, as you say, people's interests, people's commitments were moved in other directions, into directions that seemed really quite firmly grounded in this mundane, albeit oftentimes very violent world that we lived in. It's a world of enormous change, political change, I think, and social change is everything from decolonization to that involved, of course, the Vietnam War as being an example of that, or the war, the French in Algeria. But it's liberation movements, it's human rights movements. So one of the things that was always something that was seen as a criticism of the UFO world and ufology was that it was not deeply connected to the politics of the here and now. And that, to some extent, that's fair, that a lot of ufology really wasn't sort of finding a leg in or had any stake or expressed any stake in the politics of the time. And in a deeply political world, it sort of maybe seemed for a lot of people kind of irrelevant, or it seemed downright, you know, trivial. What changes, and I argue in the book, one of the things that changes it in a really important way is a whole bunch of sightings in 1973 that just pop really almost out of nowhere. And, you know, news journalists who hadn't been talking about this stuff for several years all of a sudden say, we can't ignore this. There are just all of these sightings all across the United States, and then it goes and moves into Europe as well, that we cannot ignore and we don't have an explanation for. And that is what then seems to generate this kind of what I call a renaissance of the 1970s and 1980s.
There we go. A renaissance in a sense, because there was something ominous about it all. It was, there's always been that feeling of the ominous about this. And I'm not recalling that you dealt with this in the book. I could be wrong, but there's some kind of a connection that my wife discovered and is very apparent in the letters we got and in the experiences that others had at our cabin, which is that, and I had for that matter, that there's some kind of connection between this and, as Anne put it, what we call the dead or what we call death. And this relates, I think, in some way to the sense of doom that was brought forward by World War II, that we were discussing earlier, and the advent of the atomic age, and is now climate change has kind of added pressure because there's a tremendous sense of doom in the air. Yeah. I know that my grandkids are basically furious about the world, and the hatred they feel for people who deny climate change is just amazing. I've never heard anything as like it. And I said to my eldest grandson, do you think you should be so angry? And he said, yeah, I do. I'm talking about losing my life because these people are lying.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are all kinds of cracks here in the culture. And the experience, the close encounter experience, and the UFO experience is kind of bubbling up. There's all of this disclosure pressure in Congress and counter pressure from now 14 different administrations, all saying we will not release the information we have. Arrow is basically just repeating the conclusions of the Condon report. Hmm. What does all of this mean culturally? Now, yeah. I know it's a very narrow question, but we should be very good at this. So
no, I like it. I like the big questions. That's one of the things that I love about talking about the phenomenon, because the phenomenon poses big questions. It's interesting. First, to go back to what you were saying before this, because about the '70s, you're quite right. That to me was striking, because in many ways, I might have started, you know, reading and noticing things about UFOs in the late '60s, but the '70s is when I really grew up on UFOs and alien encounters and really, really started diving deep into all of that. And in many ways, it was very formative for me. I in many ways owe my pursuing my career as an academic, but because of my fascination with, you know, diving deep into things. And it was, and what struck me when I revisited was, as you say, how dark things were in so much of the discussions of the '70s, just how utterly the sense that, as you say, doom, gloom, despair is there within the very sort of language and conversations that people were having in the '70s about things. That to me was. You know, I don't want to say I had any nostalgia for it, but I don't think, as maybe a young person, I fully appreciated how dark it was. And it's interesting. I think of it today and where we are today. And I think there is a darkness there that comes from a sense of new sorts of threats and climate change being probably the most prominent one that you describe. But it's interesting what I think today, the way I sort of see the developments that have been happening in, say, over the past 5 to 8 years, right, is that it reflects back on our sense of being highly politicized. I see a lot of dividing people into camps. I see a lot of this idea again of us and us versus them. This sense that people who think a certain way are enemies, and we will never find common ground with them. And so, the disclosure issue is a good example. All you have to do is do as I do, just because I think I need to keep tabs on it. Is you see that in the Twitterverse is the way in which people are constantly setting up sides and baiting one another. The social media, the internet, has not made anything better or easier when it comes to gaining knowledge and finding common ground. So I think that in many ways, the conversations in all these days reflect that. There's one other thing, though, that I do think is going on that has a long history in the way we've been thinking about UFOs over the decades that often gets less attention than it deserves. And that is that while a lot of, you know, people's interest or curiosity about UFOs has been revolved around anxieties and fears, a lot of it has been built around enthusiasm and excitement. And we do sort of live in this, also this Elon Musk age, right? In this Silicon Valley age of people who believe technology and AI is fabulous, right? That we're on the threshold of great new breakthroughs that are going to utterly change the nature of history, and that's not a surprise, because again, the UFOs were always thought about as futuristic, as versions of our own destiny, of our own future. So I see in a lot of the conversations also, a lot of young people see in these possibilities of captured devices that we might reverse engineer. They see something absolutely fascinating and utterly, utterly absorbing and engrossing, and therefore something that is not to be feared, but actually something to be embraced. And so there is another side to this stuff that I see playing out these days.
I agree with you. I think it is something to be embraced. I've thought that for a long time. Mm-hmm. And yet we have this remarkable secrecy. And someone like Lou Elizondo saying that what he knows about the secrecy makes him feel very somber. He used that word. And I think that personally the secrecy has got two sources. One is the fact that the defense industry has ended up with a large number of patents on processes that they did not develop but found. Mm. And you can't patent things you find. You have to patent, you have to have developed it. Mm. And their patents are all fake because they took these materials and so forth and back engineered them and then patented that. Mm. And this is why when the Schumer Amendment was gutted by the Congress, the motivation was all came from Congress people who are deeply connected to the defense industry. Mm, mm. And the other thing might be conceivably the abductions, something that the Air Force is supposed to protect us from threats from above. Yeah. And didn't. And right. I know they knew about it because David W. Webb, who was a highly placed space scientist and a consultant with every alphabet agency there was, came into our lives out of nowhere, spent time in our cabin, introduced me to an allergist, and I got epinephrine injectors and allergy shots so that I wouldn't have a fatal allergic reaction or a very serious allergic reaction to the visitors, who also tried to help me with that by telling me not to eat chocolate because it was a foundational allergy that, and they wanted to reduce the amount of histamine production in my body. So there was something going on there, and someone who knew a lot.
Yeah.
And why is it like this? I can't really understand. Could it be that there's a presence here that is enforcing this type of secrecy somehow on our authorities? Some higher presence?
It seems to me that you can see if, when you view it historically, the level of secrecy that has been embraced by government, we'll just speak here just to the U.S. government in this case, is something that you can chronicle over time. And there's two things connected to it. One is the rise of bigger government. We didn't have, you go to the 1850s and the American government was a Mickey Mouse operation back then. Go 100 years into the future and you have a mega government. You have a very large bureaucracy. With that also came then World War II. World War II is of critical importance to this secrecy thing because, of course, you have an all-out warfare on a scale nobody had seen, and people are developing all sorts of new technologies to defeat enemies, right? Very, very dangerous enemies, right? So secrecy becomes seen as essential for that. And probably the epitome of that then, of course, is the Manhattan Project, right? The invention of the atomic bomb is this big secret that is unveiled onto the world. There's a really, I can't remember the name right now, but there's a really great book by a historian who's written about the secrecy and atomic weapons in American history. And he points out that to me was really eye-opening on this. He says that what happens within the first few years of the invention of the atomic bomb, over the course of the late 40s, early 50s, at the same time that the UFO thing is starting to take shape in the form that we know it, the government is debating a decision about, you know, this fear that the Soviets are going to get this technology. What do you do to keep it out of their hands? One argument was, what we do is we keep the technology out of their hands, right? Don't let them get the literal physical material tools to build an atomic weapon. The other idea, though, however, that wins the day is, no, we're going to keep the knowledge of the atomic bomb, the knowledge of how to make it, away from people. And when you make that, when you make that your interest, what you now say is knowledge is dangerous. And when you make knowledge dangerous, it means you have to start keeping lots and lots and lots of things secret, right? You can't just lock things in a storage locker somewhere, right? You now have to stop knowledge. And that means you have to keep information from people, and you have to stop people who have information from passing it on. That to me is, I think, very eye-opening. That to me, as a historian, is the moment when we embark on a pathway that leads us, I think, right to the very present.
You know, that, and this is indeed what happened in this phenomenon, right? Primarily because it was so provocative. Nobody knew what to do about it or how it worked or even exactly what was happening, except something was. And then you begin to get these people going on the television and saying they were abducted by aliens and their sexual material was taken out of the bodies, which I remember happening to me very vividly. I can't believe it didn't happen. I wouldn't believe that for a minute, in fact. And I'm not alone. And when you have a provocation like that, and it is a provocation, it's inevitable that there is going to be pushback. If there's any truth in it, the government is, or if the government doesn't believe it's true, they're going to have to just be silent about it. I don't see where they have a choice. And, you know, they, for example, they don't really poo-poo the abduction stuff much. They ignore it. And I don't blame them for ignoring it. Now, this gets me to the narrative itself, the abduction narrative. And you can't discuss that without discussing hypnosis. Because I am deeply concerned that when I was hypnotized by Don Klein, first, Bud Hopkins wanted to hypnotize me. And I thought, I'm not going to be hypnotized by an artist. I mean, you know, he's not a professional. And I told him no. And so he proceeds to get me arguably the most skilled forensic hypnotist in the world. And forensic hypnosis is a real thing in the hands of someone who knows what they're doing. And Klein did. But then, and at the time, I had no idea that there was an abduction narrative. I touched my microphone, folks. I hope you mind. It'll be a little click in there, unless the sound guy can take it out. In any case, this narrative didn't exist when I had my experience and was hypnotized. Afterwards, though, the narrative is everywhere. Is hypnosis of any value? And if it isn't, then haven't we created a folklore?
Yeah, I think there's something folkloric. Absolutely. What's interesting is the narrative is actually there already in the 1970s. I cite in my book a lengthy paragraph. I think it's in the book by a fellow, Scott Rogo, who was by his own self-description, a paranormal investigator, who in 1980 just summarizes in an interesting paragraph the sort of archetypal abduction narrative. It's going to get fleshed out a little differently later on, but it's already there in circulation in 1980. And in already there, you know, for quite some time, people like Leo Sprinkle were already playing around with hypnosis and using hypnosis, hypnotic regression, as a way of uncovering some of this. What's interesting, and I don't know if you ever had any dealings with Leo Sprinkle. I'd be interested in hearing if you did, because I had a chance to correspond with him before he passed away. A very, very nice man, really, really gentle soul. And I had a chance to look deeply into his archive, his personal papers. And the thing that strikes me about Leo Sprinkle, who is not well known in many UFO circles, is that, you know, he was a PhD in counseling. And similar to John Mack, you know, as well, he was always very interested he was really adamant that the use of hypnosis was something very, very dangerous, that it could not just simply be thought of as a tool for investigation, that there was always going to be, when you talked with somebody having particularly an abduction encounter, you were dealing with people who needed to be dealt with from a counseling and a consoling perspective as well. And that required certain kinds of skills and talents that many people who were using hypnosis did not have, or were certainly untrained for. So he was already laying these ideas out in the late 60s, well before a lot of people like Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs and others were getting involved. So I do think there has always been a real danger with how hypnosis has been used by some people. And that's why, as you say, it really becomes incumbent upon people to find the right kind of person who has the training and expertise to know how to utilize it in ways that are going to be thoughtful and responsible.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I did know Leo, and he was, I thought he might be a saint. He was gentlest man, a good man, a genuinely good man down to his core.
Right.
And very thoughtful about this, as you say. Yeah. And I wish that thoughtfulness had been expressed more effectively into the broader community, because we have hypnosis has become a kind of, I want to say a cultural meme here, in the sense that people go, they're hypnotized and they have the expected result, and then they become abductees. And I'm just wondering if that isn't really causing a lot of dilution of the actual memories that people have. You know, there is a process that's been developed and is being, there are many papers about it now, about how it's possible using a functional MRI scanner to determine whether or not memories that are addressed in question form during the scanning process are being organized by the brain because they are imaginary or from physical experience. The difference is quite marked, apparently. And using that process, we could determine, without the need for hypnosis, what parts of people's memories are imaginary and what parts were entered their minds through their senses. I think that's a tremendous important possibility. And then the question comes, that sounds expensive. And that's an understatement.
It sounds expensive. And it does also sound a little dangerous too, in the hands of wrong people, right?
Well, that's another thing.
How that would be weaponized.
Yes, how it could be weaponized. And it's like, hypnosis and lie detectors are weaponized. There's a retired FBI agent who's always seems to be available to do lie detector tests on people, and they always fail them. I passed 3 or 4 lie detector tests, but that was before there was any pushback. And, you know, the difficulty here would be that scientists would who had no intention of being honest about the results would do this to people and claim false results. And this gets me to the difficulty we have in facing the collapse or the implosion of paradigms. And you're in the academic community, and suddenly here you are with a very distinguished academic career, and you're saying, well, I'm tired of ignoring this part of life, and I'm not going to ignore it anymore. A lot of your colleagues will say, this is ridiculous. Don't even go there. And in the scientific community, that rejection is more intense. It's so intense. If I may, folks, talk on just for a little bit more here. We'll give you an example. A physicist came to our cabin years and years ago, and we were sitting all in a circle in the place where I had originally had my abduction experience. And suddenly, this shaft, and this is during the day, this shaft of bright golden light came down from above, like about this wide into the center of the circle. You couldn't miss it. It was just extraordinary. Everyone was talking about it. And when you looked through it at other people, you could see so clearly. It was just a beautiful experience. Only the physicist couldn't see it. He couldn't see it. And for the rest of the day, he was in agony, had a tremendous headache. And I realized what this was. If he had seen it and admitted it was there, his whole paradigm would have collapsed, because his main theory at the time was that I was being affected by low frequency sound waves from my refrigerator. That was what was causing these hallucinations. And I had him up there because I was very interested in skeptically. I still am. I don't reject skeptical views at all. I'm very interested in them. So what do we do with that? Paradigm defense. Let me call it this. Paradigm defense. Where do we go if we're going to somehow or another get around that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll speak of it from what you were just talking about, from the academic world, because a lot of people ask me about the kind of response. Excuse me. The kind of response or the any reaction or blowback I've received, and about, of course, the longstanding academic rejection of even talking about these things. I don't deny that has existed, that is something that has existed and is something that still exists in certain sectors of the academic universe. This sense that, you know, there's certain things that are just off the table that can't be taken on or explored or discussed. What's interesting to me is that I think when it comes to this phenomenon, there is no question that we are going through a period in which academia, at least, if we can talk of it in broad generalizations, is far more open to discussing these kinds of things. You see it in all sorts of different areas and different kinds of discussions and different kinds of conversations about whether it's the UFO phenomenon, near-death experiences, consciousness studies, things along those lines. And it's interesting that there's a recent study that's making the, you know, the sort of circulating these days in a lot of ufology circles of an academic study that was part of a survey that was conducted a year or two ago, I think it was, among academics, asking them their different viewpoints about the UFO phenomenon and doing research on it and their attitudes about it. And to me, the most telling thing in there was not about how many people were doing research on it or wanted to do research on it. The most telling thing in there was they asked academics, if somebody in your department was doing research on UFO, on the UFO and an encounter phenomenon, would you reject them outright for tenure, right? Would that be the point at which you would say, I'm sorry, you are not going to have a future in our department? Because that's exactly where academics tend to say, that's where we police our field, our profession. And only 7% of academics said, yes, I would reject somebody for that reason. The rest did not. That tells me there is an inherent categorical openness to it. Now, it doesn't mean that they always would follow through on that. But it seems to me that we are very much at a period of time, at least in my world that I see and I and the people I talk to, of a greater openness to have broader, wider conversations and discussions about this. And more specifically, to do research on this, to write about this stuff, and to really do the kinds of deep dives that so many other people have been doing for so long, we're gonna be late to the show. That's for sure.
Yeah, but the show you're going to be late to is also one that can't really open without you. So one of the areas that I think is so important is to really take a look at the relationship between modern encounters and experiences of things in the sky and what has gone on in the past and how these things such as incidents of light and so forth affect culture. Mm-hmm. And how they change the way we think about the world around us and about ourselves. Because it's in directions like that that we can begin to get really in-depth perspective on just exactly where our minds take us when we come up against something that in the past generated folklore, which is you see something strange in the woods of a flickering light or a little being seemingly racing away as you walk ahead or even standing there before you. And then you use your culture and your education to create an idea of what you saw. Mm-hmm. And that's where the fairy lore comes from and so much other lore and the UFO lore too.
Yeah.
It's behind it.
Yeah. Right.
Because the scientists can't figure this out. It's the academics who've got to go down that.
Yeah, and if I can put in a word for my team in academia, we humanists, we're the ones who can do those things, right? I mean, not to say I don't know plenty of natural scientists, you know, and physicists and chemists who have a real thoughtful and insightful way of looking for deeper meanings and things. I do like to sometimes just put in a word for us folks in the humanities and arts who are the ones who really spend most of our lives cogitating about these things and trying to find ways to make sense of them. I've always been struck, and if I can ask you a question, I've always been struck in your own writing how you've come to also use myth as a way of trying to make things right. You invoke mythology oftentimes as well, right? What role do you see mythology playing? Is it different than just simple folklore, or is it much the same kind of role for you?
It has a different energy than folklore, and it emerges from a different place in the psyche. Mm. Myth is story in its purest form. in that it expresses the deepest conflicts of human experience. Folklore arises in many ways, one of which is mythical, another of which is physical. In other words, people have experiences that they can't explain, and they use their cultural context to explain them, and that is what folklore is, a lot of us to folklore. Myth is different. Myth is reaching down into the depths of the human soul for story and finding story there. And what story is, it's not simply a tale. It is a tale told about conflict. That's what story is. And that's why all myth is so deeply connected with conflict. And the oldest myths in which you find in Hinduism, for example, are very much about conflict and very deep and very subtle. Like there's a goddess, Sri Bala, who is a 9-year-old girl goddess. And she's a goddess because she went out and fought in and won a battle against a huge army. This is the core essence of the childhood experience. And that goddess, who is hardly known in the modern world, because she's a wonderful example of myth making.
Yeah, that's interesting. That distinction that you just drew for me, that's very helpful for me, because I've been trying to get my head wrapped around what that distinction is between myth and folklore. And in a sense, for me, what I hear you saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is the other part of it, as you say, is it's pure story. It's story pure, in a sense, in that sense that it's also more archetypal than folklore, right? Folklore is maybe more deeply embedded in a locality, in a sense.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I think that folklore arises out of experience, mostly. Or do you see something strange and you explain it, and that becomes folklore? But myth arises out of the fundamental conflicts of the human experience, and that's why it's so associated with deities.
Yeah,
because all of us contain our own gods, and when we decide that some universal conflict is so powerful that we externalize it and make it into a deity. Well, like, for example, the Jews of Israel in the old days, they were a little tribe, very obviously had a very highly developed and complex culture, but they were nowhere near as powerful as the Egyptians, the Babylonians, or anyone around them. And in those days, your power was defined by the power of your God, and you were defined by your God's power. And so all of their myths are about an angry, ever dissatisfied God, Yahweh, who is dissatisfied, obviously, because he doesn't give them the kind of support they need, and they keep getting captured and dragged off to Babylon or swept out of Egypt, et cetera, and so forth. They're wanderers trying to find a home. And this is so deeply embedded in them. Their whole culture is about wandering to this day. I mean, right now, they are hanging on to Israel by their fingernails, surrounded on all sides by vast populations that want to sweep them right into the sea. It's been their fate from the beginning, and their story and their God reflect that.
Fascinating.
Thank you. We have been together for, gosh, a long time. It seems like the timer says an hour and 34 minutes. It's really been fun, man.
It has, yes. This has been wonderful. Thanks.
Okay. the After the Flying Saucers Came, A Global History of the UFO Phenomenon. And frankly, folks, we just scratched the surface of this wonderful book. Greg, thank you so much for being with me on Dreamland.
Oh, thank you so much, Whitley.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.